I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. A Harris poll in September found that 99% of adults believe that personal finance should be taught in high school. While most schools don't offer those courses, it might not be a bad idea for teenagers and their parents because there's a high rate of financial illiteracy in the United States. Making smart money decisions these days has gotten more complicated than in past years and probably more important because it's so easy to rack up a lot of debt through credit cards or student loans or mortgage problems. So can we teach better money management skills? And we begin our conversation with Olivia Mitchell. She's a professor of insurance risk management, business economics, and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Joins us from the studios of Wharton. And Olivia Mitchell, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
So what does it mean to be financially literate these days?
Well, there are a number of possible definitions, but the one I prefer is that a financially literate individual is someone who has the ability to process economic information and make informed financial decisions around saving, investment, and the drawdown of one's assets.
I said in my introduction that it's more complicated these days to be financially literate. Let me check, do a little fact check with you. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely do. Back in the good old days, people took care of you. Institutions took care of you. The government played a much bigger role in our retirement planning decisions. Employers offered defined benefit plans. We're in a much different world now, and baby boomers and everyone younger than that has to bear a much larger share of the responsibility of working a long time, saving effectively, and then not running out of money in retirement.
Mm. I mean, we're more on our own these days, do you think?
Absolutely. I think it's because employers have backed off from the cradle-to-grave treatment of benefits. Many of us switch employers a lot. And the government, quite frankly, is running short of money in terms of its big expenditure programs.
Do you find that people overestimate their expertise when it comes to their own personal finances?
Well, it's interesting. We've done a number of financial literacy surveys, and what we find consistently, in not only in the U.S. but around the world, is that women are less likely to have correct answers for our three key questions. Men are more likely to get them right. However, if the men don't know the answer, they just presume that they know it, even if it's wrong, whereas women are much more likely to say, I don't know. So in that sense, I suspect that women are more teachable.
Well, that's interesting. We could do a whole hour on your answer right there. One of the questions that you asked was, do you think the following statement is true or false? Quote, buying a single company stock usually provides a safer return than a stock mutual fund. What did you find when you looked for the answers to that question?
Well, in terms of the baby boomers, because that was one group we focused on as they're heading right into retirement, only 18% got that question right across the board. And so that was very disturbing. If you look at all ages, we still have a fairly low level of understanding. About 52% of the total population gets it correct. And I think that speaks to the fact that younger people are much more exposed to financial markets than our parents and grandparents have been over their lifetimes.
But do you think it's important to know about what inflation means or what bond prices are about or interest rates or risk or mortgages? I'm thinking of all these issues that have been in the news certainly since the recession of 2008.
Well, the financial crisis certainly put these issues into sharp contrast. And what we know is that a number of people had taken out auto loans, student loans, credit card loans, and of course the big one, mortgage loans. Mm-hmm. And they really didn't understand what they were getting into with the adjustable rate interest, for example. But what we also know is that, more broadly speaking, people who are less financially literate don't save as much, they don't accumulate much wealth, they have a lot more debt, and they respond to irrelevant cues instead of really seeing through what's going on in terms of the product advertisement.
And when you look at the population, who are those most at risk?
Well, the people who turn out to be the least informed, and this is true not only in the U.S., but in a number of other countries, are young adults, and that's important because three-quarters of them have credit card debt, older people, and also African Americans and women, groups that have not necessarily had as much power and control over wealth as in the past. One interesting fact that you do find is that if women are married and their husbands become ill and then pass away, we see an improvement in those women's financial literacy the closer they get to their husband's death.
Well, and that gets us back to some of these gender issues. That's pretty interesting.
Yes, I think the key issue, though, is one of causality. That is, over time, we found a lot of association between higher levels of wealth, lower levels of debt, and more financial literacy. But the core question, of course, is whether the correlation is also causation. In research that we've done, we've found it's not some obvious omitted factors, like we've controlled on IQ, we've controlled on education. There's still a big effect of financial literacy. In fact, the effects are even larger.
Well, and I do want to get to whether you think this stuff is teachable, but I'm also thinking about the fine print that we're often asked to read if we're signing some kind of a financial document. And I have to say, you know, I think of myself as a pretty educated person, and that stuff is really hard to understand.
Well, in particular, as you get older, it's harder to see as well.
Because it is fine print. I know that
exactly.
Feeling.
Exactly. Well, one of the issues that many countries have tried to put into practice is a standardization of the descriptions. So, for example, a mutual fund prospectus will have standardized information always in the same location. They've done the same thing in Europe. And I think that does help. If people take the effort to go and read the forms, then they can do better comparing across products.
Let me give out the phone number to our listeners. It's 1-888-477-9499. Do you feel educated enough and knowledgeable enough to make financial decisions, smart financial decisions? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Olivia Mitchell, is this stuff then teachable? Are we teachable as a species to understand some of these financial decisions?
I believe it's absolutely the case that we can teach people. It helps if people are more interested, of course. And so one of the very key bits of information that we have is that different states at different points in time have mandated financial education in the high schools. And there's been a big outpouring of literature demonstrating that young adults, which grew up in those states where they were exposed to the financial education, are a lot more financially savvy. Now, there's more that needs to be learned. What kind of education is the best? Is it sufficient if the football coach teaches the course? Maybe not. Depends on what the coach knows. But we do know, for example, a new study that just came out from the Federal Reserve in New York shows that young adults that lived in those states where they'd been exposed to financial literacy, they're better at repaying their debt. They're less reliant on kind of bad types of debt like credit cards and auto loans. And so that effect is very strong, even above and beyond how much mathematics or other education they've had in high school.
Are these standalone courses, or are they incorporated into courses about economics or courses about algebra or mathematics?
I think ideally they should be incorporated, but in many of the states they'll have a separate course which focuses on things like maybe simple things like balancing your checkbook, planning, budgeting, things of that nature. But as the push to expand financial literacy increases, I think those courses should integrate across the board. In fact, I think in my own case, I started teaching my kids when they first started asking for an allowance.
Well, do you think teachers are, should we have football coaches teaching financial literacy?
Well, if they're savvy, absolutely. Wharton has been running a program for high school teachers for a couple years now. And they're keen to learn. Many of them know that they need to be able to impart this material to the students, but they might not necessarily know what's first. So I see this as a very excellent first step.
Let me see what Sue from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Sue, it sounds like we left you hanging. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks. I just have a question. I heard you mentioned that you did a survey, whether it's better to invest in a single stock versus a mutual fund. And I didn't hear you reveal the answer to that. Did I miss it?
Well, no. But Sue, let me put you on the spot here. What do you think the answer is, Sue?
I would think the mutual funds. But maybe
hooray!
you got that right. Go ahead, Olivia Mitchell.
No, I think the a lot of the advice you might find online is, hey, invest in what you know. So if you have a good meal at a fast food joint, then go out and buy that stock. And my point is that if you're really trying to save for retirement, not just play in the market, but save for retirement in a sensible, well-organized way, then you really ought to diversify risk. I would take that point one step further. A lot of people, especially in the run-up to the financial crisis, put all their assets, all their money in one house.
Yes.
And it turns out that's not a good diversification strategy either.
But are you arguing for or saying we need to make sure that high schools teach financial literacy?
I do believe that's important. I think it's most important, and you can show that the impact is the largest for people who are the least educated. So if someone's already headed to college, maybe that's going to have less of an impact. But if you really focus on the least educated, then you can have potentially the biggest gain.
And do you think there should be a refresher course for people who are members of Congress?
Absolutely. Maybe that'll help them get through their next budget crisis discussion.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but I asked you that because I have to say I was pretty shocked. I imagine you were pretty shocked about some of the commentary over the last couple of weeks when it came to the government shutdown and also came to the possible default.
Well, I think that Americans tend to be very insular and we focus on our own knitting probably more than we should. The fact is, if we want to remain a strong country internationally, we must keep the dollar strong and we must keep the full faith and credit of the U.S. strong. So I hope that's a lesson that people in Congress have learned.
We're going to be talking with someone later in the show about money and parents and children, but do you think there's also a responsibility that parents have, as you mentioned yourself, to help their children understand about the world of finance?
I think it's a very good idea to start young. So, for example, if the kids had a little summer job or mowed the lawn or something, I made them save half of it, and then they could spend half. And then I also developed a spreadsheet, which I called the Bank of Mom. And so then they could spend within those limits, and they understood budgeting quite quickly.
Well, on that note, I'm going to think about the Bank of Mom. Olivia Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thanks for doing the show.
You're very welcome. She's a professor of insurance risk management, business economics, and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Joined us from the studios of Wharton. We have John Lynch waiting in the wings, and we want to hear from you as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about financial illiteracy or financial literacy, no matter how you want to look at it. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theatre supports WHYY and presents Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, October 29th through November 24th. The timeless love story of Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy comes to life on the BRT stage with a fast-paced and engaging adaptation by John Jory, filled with romance, laughter, and memorable characters. Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice has captivated generation after generation. Tickets at 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the fall membership campaign here at WHYY. If you are a member subscriber, we thank you for your support. We could not do this without you. If you're not a member yet, take just a few minutes and become one since you're listening to Radio Times. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499, and you can pledge online at whyy.org. For a $60 pledge, we'll send you a Radio Times mug designed by our very own Tony Auth. So do it, please. Thanks.
Moore College of Art and Design joins you in support of WHYY and will host its open house on Sunday, October 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. for its career-focused co-ed graduate studies programs taught by professionally active faculty in an intimate campus environment on the Parkway. Alumni, faculty, and program managers will be available for you to speak with, and the galleries at Moore and the Art Shop will be open. For more on Moore College of Art and Design's October 27th open house, moore.edu. Or 215-965-4016.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. As we all know, the financial system is more complicated than ever before, and it does take some know-how to avoid burdensome debts and bad decision-making when it comes to our finances. Joining us now is John Lynch. He's director of the Center for Research on Consumer Financial Decision-Making. He's the Ted Anderson Professor of Free Enterprise at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and one of the authors of a new study called Financial Literacy, Financial Education, and Downstream Financial Behaviors, published in the Journal of Management Science. And John Lynch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. I know you were listening in as Olivia Mitchell was talking about financial literacy, and I'm going to ask you the same question I asked her to begin our conversation. How do you define financial literacy? What do you need to know?
I think financial literacy is really a set of skills for being able to cope with your personal financial circumstances.
And what do you mean by skills?
So those skills really have to do with money management, being able to plan, being able to manage a risk, to borrow when appropriate, save when appropriate.
So things like understanding about bonds and stocks and debt and interest rate and mortgages, all the sort of basics that we think of associated with finance?
Well, I'd say that that what you just described have to do with knowledge
right.
of personal finance, and that stuff is important. But I'd say financial literacy is really a set of skills that help you make good financial decisions. So knowledge is just a piece of that.
Well, but do you think people are sort of irrational then when it comes to their money?
I wouldn't say irrational, but I would say that that financial behaviors are controlled by more than just what we know. So there are some financial behaviors that are controlled by our habits, some financial behaviors that are controlled by emotions and issues of self-control and so on. So knowledge is a piece of the puzzle, but it's not the entire puzzle.
And when you say emotions, I mean, that can cover the gamut. And I think we all know some of our own emotions associated with our money. But can you expand on that a bit?
Sure. So for example, in the say you're talking about in the domain of investing.
Right.
So investors may sell in a panic when from their retirement fund when the market starts to go bad, for example, or a consumer may be overwhelmed with a desire to have some particular expensive high-tech appliance. Those are all things where emotion comes into play.
So Olivia Mitchell was talking about the fact that she believes that you can teach some financial literacy, maybe based on knowledge and fact. Are you saying it's not so easy?
Well, I think that basically what I'm saying is that financial literacy, if you're trying to teach financial literacy, that that there is a range of skills that are involved, not just knowledge of financial facts and so on. And
Can that be taught?
That's
okay. But can that be taught? I mean, if we understand ourselves better, can we? And we have some knowledge of the financial system. Does that help us make better financial decisions?
I would say yes. But the point of our study is we did a study that aggregated what has been found in every study that's ever been published on the area of financial literacy and financial education. And the connection to downstream financial behaviors.
Right.
And so as Olivia Mitchell was mentioning in her piece, some of those studies are more correlational and some of them are testing the effects of financial education interventions. And probably the biggest takeaway from our study was how small the effects were of financial education on downstream financial behavior. So on average, across all these studies, whether you got the financial education or not, explained about 0.1% of the variation among people and whether they did the good or the bad behavior.
So when she talked about a couple of states that have financial education as part of the education system, and she seemed to indicate there were some positive benefits there, are you questioning that?
Well, our study really didn't focus on high school financial education in particular. It focused on financial education of all types, so financial education in the workplace, financial education that's by NGOs, and financial education that's formal financial education. And basically, what we found is that the effects on average were small, but there were a couple things that were critical. And one of them is that the effects of financial education, probably like other kinds of education, go away if you don't use it right away.
Right.
And so what we found is that even a very, very large dose, something the length of a college course, for example, had no measurable effects on behavior once you got about 20 months out.
And is that because you're not adding and subtracting? I mean, some of the sort of basic skills of our education system?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a matter of it's a little bit of a matter of speculation exactly what the results mean. But what the facts show is that basically, as you might imagine, if you give me financial education, you give me a big dose for more hours, right, it has a bigger effect on my behavior than if you give me a small dose. And then, as you might expect, if you give me some education and you wait several months, it has less effect than if you measure the effect right away. But those things go together. And I think when you open at the top of your show with so many Americans thinking that high school financial education is a great thing,
yes,
there's the issue of, well, okay, are we hoping that it's going to affect our kids' behavior when they get to college and adulthood? And there I think that the results from our research show that it's a little heroic to expect those effects.
But I think it also raises questions about the quality of instruction. I mean, it's all well and good to say, yes, children should have a good background in financial education, but do we have the teachers with the kind of knowledge and skill set, to be able to teach children or high schoolers about finance?
Yeah, I think that's a super interesting question. So this research that we did was funded by the National Endowment for Financial Education, which is a wonderful organization that funds research in this area. And that is one of their initiatives to try to understand more about teacher training. But I would say that what I'm saying is not shouldn't be surprising. It's mm-hmm. it should be true of any kind of education. So if you use it or lose it. And so I think one of the things is that some of these broad-based courses have the philosophy that if only we would teach kids sort of good habits early on, they would keep them for a lifetime. But if you're teaching me something about mortgage repayment and what the nature is of different kinds of mortgage forms or things about saving for retirement, and I'm sitting there as a high school kid,
mm-hmm.
That isn't relevant at that particular point in time. And so by the time it comes for the person to make use of it, basically the knowledge is gone. And I guess the other thing I would say about it is that teachers that are teaching financial education just have a very tough task that other teachers don't face, which is that for other teachers, they don't have everybody in the world telling kids a different way to do it. But with money stuff, you go home, your parents tell you something different than your aunt and uncle do, and then there's self-interested sellers out there telling you what to do. So I think that financial education has a hard time getting share of voice to have any measurable effect on behavior.
Let me reintroduce you, and I do want to give out that phone number again. John Lynch, our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's director of director of the Center for Research on Consumer Financial Decision Making. And in this hour of the show, we're taking a look at financial literacy or illiteracy, however you want to define it. And we want to hear from you. Do you feel like you have the kind of knowledge base to make smart financial decisions, smart decisions about money matters? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. John Lynch, I know that you have looked at something called just-in-time education, which I think picks up on what you were just saying about if we're going to teach some of this financial literacy, how do we do it? What is just-in-time education?
Well, I think the result is that that we show that the effects of education on behavior decay. And so the strongest effects are pretty shortly after the education. So that, to me, suggests, or to me and to my co-authors, who are Daniel Fernandez, who's at Erasmus University, and Rick Neddemeyer at the University of Virginia, To us, that suggests that if the financial educators should be thinking about what behaviors they're trying to influence. So if you have, say, high school kids in your class, what behaviors are immediately relevant to them? And how can we get financial education to them at a point in time that's close to when they're facing specific decisions and they can act on it? Because it's only if they elaborate that that knowledge transmitted and those skills transmitted are they likely to stick for any protracted period of time.
Well, let me pick up on that. Let's say there's a student applying to college and is thinking about taking a college loan. Would that be the time then to teach them about what that would entail?
Yeah, I think it's a great focus for high school financial education. So given there are states like Virginia, for example, where it exists, make the best of it. So decisions about whether to go to college, what college to choose? Should I go to a private institution or should I go to a public university? What major should I pick? How should I finance it? Those are all things that are coming up the pipe, coming down the pipe for those high school students. And those are all cases where I think financial education could be just in time, and where there could be, there could be significant benefit.
Almost.
On the other hand, there are other things that are more long, that are farther in the distance, and I would say those are things that are that maybe are not as useful in the curriculum.
Well, I'm thinking about, let's say someone wants to buy a house, and we all know about the problems that many people got into when the recession really nearly took down the economy and the financial system. How do you find, if someone wants to take out a mortgage, how do you get them that just-in-time education?
Yeah, that's a very interesting problem. So there is an effort actually at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau around what are called recommender systems, where there are portals that are supposed to have information that will be unbiased and neutral, but providing information to help people through with specific decisions. So I think part of what just-in-time would entail would be to have whatever education you're offering not be attempting to be broad-based, covering everything under the sun, but being more laser-focused on particular behaviors you're trying to help.
I mean, there are certain periods in people's life where they think about buying a house, or they think about sending their child to college, or even think about retirement as well. And these are all such important decisions that have, the potential financial impact is just enormous.
That's right, and there are states that have programs, for example, for first-time home buyers to have some financial education around that and some coaching around that. And to me, those things seem like they're just in time, and they're more promising than certain other efforts that are more distant from the behaviors they're trying to influence.
Do you think that should be mandatory? And as you said earlier, there's so much there's so many people trying to influence our financial decisions.
Well, the thing about mandatory. I think the results from our paper, by showing how contrary to our intuitions the actual results are, suggests that nothing should be mandatory unless it's tested. So for new financial education interventions, instead of having the presumption that they're going to be effective, we should start with the presumption that they may be pretty ineffective, and that, however, that maybe people may have some novel way to implement things that will result in different effects than what's been studied so far, because only a subset of the kinds of financial education have been studied so far. So let's keep trying new things, but let's test them before we do some massive rollout.
Well, let's get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Michael from Old City, Philadelphia, joining us on Radio Times. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Sure. Thanks, Marty.
Sure.
My question is, considering the facts that you're bringing out from your study, what would your opinion be as to this whole move towards an individual-based financial decision-making in the United States, which seems to run against the current in every other Western industrial democracy of doing centrally-based financial, social financial systems? Because they're just simply, what we're trying to do is just simply inefficient and not effective.
Michael, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. What do you think, John Lynch?
Well, I think that Michael's alluding to there's sort of a range of things that policymakers can do to help us make better financial decisions. And financial education is just one piece of it. Another piece of it is effective regulation. So when there are fraudulent or deceptive sellers and so on, to protect us in those events. And then there's a whole other category of ways to try to help us make better financial decisions that are based in behavioral economics, sometimes called nudges, in the famous book by Thaler and Sunstein. And so in a nudge, for example, when I moved here to the University of Colorado in 2009, they had a setup that they had a set of 401k retirement programs, but if I didn't take the effort to sign up, they automatically enrolled me in one. So that those kind of auto enrollment and starting people off where you're defaulted into some financial behavior that is likely to be helpful to you, that's one tool in the arsenal. But what I would say about that is that if different people need different things, if what I should sign up for is different from what you should sign up for, and the same thing with mortgages, et cetera, in those areas, then I think that consumers need to know something, and that's where I think the just-in-time financial education comes into play.
Do you think when it comes to finances that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing?
Overconfidence can be a dangerous thing, but underconfidence can be too. So in some of these bad financial behaviors, they happen because we put our heads in the sand. For example, like in the retirement arena, if we sign up and we don't pay any attention once we've signed up, then that can be a problem. Or if our mortgage was underwater and we won't answer the phone or answer the mail when somebody is trying to offer some alternative way for us to get out from underneath that mortgage. So being too confident is a problem, but being too underconfident is also a problem.
I also think, money is so loaded. I mean, it can mean security, it can mean power, it can mean shame. I mean, there's so many, as you were touching on earlier, about some of these emotions that are really tied up with how we think about and probably how we spend our money.
Yeah, I think that's really, really true. And that is part of, I think, the limitation on financial education, because financial education attempts to be, you know, pretty neutral and factual. And some of the things that control our behaviors are much more personal and emotional, and how I feel about my money might be different from how you feel about your money. And so no teacher will go in there in the classroom and tell everybody they should do it the same way. And so I think that part of that, you know, what's right for me might not be right for you is part of the challenge of traditional financial education.
I hear you. I asked Olivia Mitchell the same question. I'll put it to you, our final question in this second of three segments in this hour of Radio Times. But do you think financial documents should be just more user-friendly so we can not only read the fine print, but also understand it?
Yeah, we actually have another project here. The answer is radically so, that what is considered to be simple is way too complex for the average consumer. So, for example, we have a project on annuities, which is, you know, a financial product for making your savings in retirement last for a lifetime.
Right.
And we tried to find the complicated and simple brochures for products available in the market, and the simplest brochures we found were so radically complex that people couldn't even keep their attention throughout reading them.
Oh, I've read those documents. John Lynch, thank you very much for joining us and during Radio Times today.
Thank you so much.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
For having me.
You're welcome. And he's director of the Center for Research on Consumer Financial Decision Making, also the Ted Anderson Professor of Free Enterprise at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And we have a third guest waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about parenting, money, and values. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents the Hungarian State Folk Ensemble Sunday, November 3rd in Verizon Hall. One of the world's foremost folkloric dance troupes, the ensemble has promoted Hungarian culture worldwide for over 50 years. Their new program, Hungarian Rhapsody, is a journey from the present to the past and back again, inspired by Hungary's rich folk music and dance tradition. Tickets for the Hungarian State Folk Ensemble at KimmelCenter.org.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Today on the show, we're talking about the importance of financial literacy and the connection between smoking and poverty, especially here in Philadelphia. Speaking of financial literacy, we have budgets and have to pay our bills just like you. It costs money to produce shows like Radio Times. Help us defray the cost by calling 1-888-345-9499 and become a supporter of WHYY. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University, featuring An Evening with Bob Woodward, Friday, November 1st at 8 p.m. on the Westchester University campus. Part of the President's Speaker Series, Woodward will be presenting a talk on presidential leadership and the price of politics. Since 1971, Woodward has worked on the Washington Post, where he is currently an associate editor. He and Carl Bernstein were the main reporters on the Watergate scandal, for which the Post won the Pulitzer Prize in 1973. wcupa.edu/wcu live.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We've been talking about why it's so hard to be financially literate these days. And joining us now is Ron Lieber. He's a New York Times columnist currently on leave to work on a book about parenting and money and values to be called The Opposite of Spoiled. And Ron Lieber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Do we have him? Do we have you, Ron Lieber? Hi, Ron Lieber.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. How are you?
Very good. That was a little pregnant pause there, but I'm glad we got hooked up. What got you interested in kids and money?
It started with a phone call I got a couple of years ago, right around the time that Occupy Wall Street was popping up. It was from a couple of parents, different schools, who basically had the same conversation with me. They'd seen some of the things I'd written about kids and money in the New York Times in the Your Money column, where I write about personal finance, and they were having issues in their schools where the people who had a little bit more than average were starting to feel demonized, and the people who had a little bit less felt like their noses were being rubbed in it, and nobody was talking out loud about any of these issues. The school wasn't doing much to lead these conversations, and they asked me to come and set everybody straight.
And a book was born. I was talking with our previous two guests about just how complicated our financial system is and how complicated it is for adults to be financially literate. Do you think that's true for kids as well?
It is. Well, here's what they're up against right now. You've got a couple things going on. First of all, we're asking 16, 17, and 18-year-olds to make six-figure decisions about college and what they and their parents are going to spend, what their priorities are, and perhaps how much debt both the parents and the students are willing to get into to finance that education. And it may be a $50,000 education if you go to community college for a couple of years and then live at home and then go to the local state university. Could be even less than that, depending on where you go, what sort of financial aid you get. But there are lots of people who are taking on close to six figures in debt as teenagers to go to school. And then on the back end, you're graduating into a world where the economy hasn't completely recovered. And I think you can make a pretty good case that, we haven't taxed ourselves quite enough to pay for the promises that we have asked the government to make for us. And one way or another, that's probably going to mean fewer services that people are going to have to pay for out of their own pocket, or higher taxes that people are going to have to pay out of their own market, out of their own pocket. So either way, people are going to be graduating into a world with more, not fewer, financial responsibilities, which means you're just going to have to be that much more ready in your 20s than people used to be a generation ago.
You've made an interesting comparison, which is, and if parents are talking to their children about sex or about money, that it's now harder to talk about money than sex?
I think it is the last taboo. I mean, if you just look at what's going on in the classroom, there are very few schools at this point that don't do some form of sex education in health, or, sort of talking about it in science or other classes too. But if you look at the sort of money education that goes on, there's very little of it. And, I actually think that this sort of thing has to begin at home. There are all sorts of ways that you can do it as a parent starting at a relatively early age. But the problem is that I think parents, many of them at least, avoid the money conversation even more than they avoid the sex conversation. The sex conversation, there's a biological imperative, right? I mean, kids are going through puberty. It's clear the things are happening to their bodies and that they're thinking about sex all the time. It would be almost abnormal not to as a teenager. And so parents know they have to do something, right? But there's no biological imperative around money, and I think parents don't quite realize that the financial imperative is, in fact, there until it's too late.
But, you know, I do think maybe parents are not talking directly with their children about money, but children see their parents spending money or arguing about money or worrying about money, that the money is, you know, is sort of woven into family life, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, look, kids are sponges, and it's their, you know, we think that they learn from books and they learn from the things that we tell them directly, but in fact, they're observing their teachers, they're observing their peers, they're observing their screens, and certainly they're observing their parents all the time. So whatever it is, you know, parents are doing, you know, kids are picking things up because they're, you know, observing on purpose, or they're just sort of picking it up by osmosis and sort of picking up habits that they are going to carry with them, even if they do not realize it and even if the parents do not realize it. So, you know, whatever it is that you're doing around money, and we interact with it, you know, in all sorts of ways each day in ways that we may not recognize, it's going to teach them something for better or for worse.
I do want to get to our callers, but let me ask you about allowance. And, of course, this is, you know, the issue that parents trying to figure out, do you tie allowance to chores and activities? Is it money that the children get to spend willy-nilly however they want? Do you have a philosophy about allowance?
You know, I had a philosophy about allowance until relatively recently, and, you know, I'm starting to question a little bit. My feeling is that, you know, allowance is a teaching tool, and it shouldn't be tied to chores, because if you tie it to chores, then the kids can go on strike, right? They can say, well, I don't need the money. I don't want the money, and so I'm just not going to do the chores. But chores, I think most people think, you know, chores should be part of what you do as a member of the household in the same way that the parents don't get compensated for the chores. So that's the danger in tying the two together. But, you know, I was talking that over with somebody in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago who grew up with very little money and still lives, you know, essentially hand to mouth, but is now trying to, you know, sort of do better by her own kids in terms of their own education. And she sees that whole notion of allowance as a teaching tool to be sort of a rich person's conceit. That, you know, in the real world, you get paid for the things that you do, and she wants to directly tie her children's efforts with compensation at the earliest possible moment in order to instill a work ethic. And, you know, I had a hard time arguing with that. Maybe the term is the problem. Maybe, maybe it's not an allowance. Maybe we should just, you know, talk about it as a budget, right? This is just, you know, the money that you're going to have, and you know, chores are something different. And maybe there's a new way of conceiving it. But, you know, I'm still working this through, and you know, my opinion before sort of put me in the minority. I think most parents at this point, surveys show 70%, 80%, 85% do tie allowance to chores. And if you don't do the chores, you don't get the allowance.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, that's Ron Lieber, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, a New York Times columnist, currently on leave to work on a book about parenting and about money values called, to be called, The Opposite of Spoiled. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email or a tweet to radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me see what Kristen from, looks like, Arlington County, Virginia has to say. Kristen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Really wonderful show.
Thank you.
I'm calling because I'm the mother of four college-age students, and I'm also a music teacher in Arlington County Public Schools. And I think that you guys are right in that financial education needs to start in the home. Simple things like don't steal, don't cuss, don't rack up debt. And secondly, my children had wonderful financial literacy wrapped into their mathematics courses. And I think that financial literacy needs to be taught from the institutions that are that are giving us our products. For example, I don't think that credit card companies should be sending my unemployed college-age students credit card applications.
I'm with you, Kristen. Yes.
And I would also say that in Virginia, we are mandating a one-year financial literacy course. And from my perspective as a music teacher, it's making kids forcing kids to not take band and orchestra and art electives because their only elective slot needs to be given over to financial literacy course.
Well, you know, Kristen, I'm going to cut you off only because we have just a couple of minutes. I don't want to get too deep in the battle between financial literacy courses and art and music. But, Ron, it's interesting that some school districts are picking up on this notion and trying to teach financial literacy.
Right. You know, the thing that the caller picked up on that I think is important is that school systems are constrained, highly constrained systems, right? It's not like there's extra money being given to our school systems right now. So the point at which you mandate a financial literacy course, it means taking something else away. It doesn't mean adding that on. I mean, sometimes you can integrate it into, you know, existing, you know, math curricula or other things like that. But even so, you know, those same math teachers are under a lot of pressure to teach to the various, you know, bubble tests that all their kids have to take along the way. So it is hard. But I have no problem with schools trying to do it. I just, you know, wonder whether kids might learn more if they pick these things up on an as-needed basis along the way. And I do believe that it has to begin with the home, and parents stand a pretty good chance of doing a better job than the schools can if they're paying attention.
What about presents and parents buying things for their kids? As you said, you're wrestling a bit with allowance. Have you come to a conclusion on this one?
Yeah, I think it's possible to put a, you know, relatively straightforward system into place where, you know, after a certain point, once the kids are conscious of money, you know, the parents can say, look, you know, we will buy you a couple of things on your birthday and around the holiday season in December. But anything else that you want, as opposed to need, anything else that you want during the year is going to need to come out of your allowance. And, you know, you have the kids, you know, divide up, you know, the money they get from allowance into, you know, say three jars, you know, for spending, for saving, and for giving the money away to some good cause. You know, and the spend jar can be for sort of small, you know, discretionary purposes, kind of off the cuff. The save jar can be, you know, saving for larger things, say, you know, a video game system or an electronic music player or you know, a special toy or something along those lines. And then you give them just enough money so that they have to make a lot of difficult choices, but not so little that they can't get anything at all that they want. And then they learn to delay gratification. They learn to shop carefully. They learn to weigh wants and needs. You know, all the things that grown-ups often have trouble with. You can begin instilling that at the earliest possible moment.
Well, it's interesting you say about grown-ups because especially with things like Amazon, I mean, it is so easy to have Christmas almost every day just by pushing that button.
Mm-hmm. It's true. As much as I love Amazon Prime and having everything show up in 48 hours, I mean, literally everything under the sun,
yes.
It is so easy to push that button. And the great thing about having kids spend 10 or 15 years dealing with green cash money in jars is that it's much more visceral. And you don't want to introduce them to the magic buy button until it's absolutely necessary, you know, probably until college. This becomes difficult if and when they have their own device or their own handheld device or their own phone, you know, which may have access to an app store. You know, you're going to want to be very careful about kind of issuing instructions on that and, you know, whose credit card gets assigned to that button on the kid's phone. So you've got to be wary of it. But, you know, having them handle the money themselves earlier rather than later, I think, begins to instill a lot of these values and virtues that we want them to take in.
Well, let me get back to our callers, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, it looks like David from Lower Merion joining us on the show. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank
you. Good morning. You're welcome.
Actually, very, very timely, because the thing I was calling about, my daughter's now a senior in college, and I'm glad you do this program like a couple times a year, talk about financial literacy, because
yes.
back when she was about four, I heard a similar program and got a great idea about allowance, where she started getting $3 a week, $1 and change that she had to count out to make a dollar and learn counting to 100. $1 went into an envelope that said, only items over $5, so the long-term savings, and $1 went into an envelope marked college that she had to put away to learn that she was going to college and that saving for college was something you had to really plan for. And I felt that I can see how well she manages money now. So, in fact, when she turned 18, I made her get a credit card knowing she'd be able to manage it, and she has, to start getting financial credit, you know, real credit and credit report early on.
Well, look, that's a great story, David. And Ron Lieber, it seems, you know, this can be done. And it doesn't sound like it was a great burden for anybody based on what David just told us.
Right. You know, not every system is going to work for every child. Every kid is different. If you have more than one kid, those kids themselves may be different. The one thing I loved about what David mentioned is the college part of this, right? I mean, we talked before about just how staggering the costs are now for the grown-ups, let alone the kids that may be taking on some of the debt. And, you know, one thing that it sounds like David did was that, you know, he made it clear to his child that she was going to be responsible for some of it. And there's a parent that I'm writing about in the book. He and his wife had four kids, and they made it clear to all of them when they turned 13 that they were going to be responsible for the first semester of tuition at college they went to. And they had, you know, basically five summers to figure it out, and the parents, you know, sort of helped them figure out, you know, what sort of budget they needed and how much they needed to save and what sort of jobs might provide that kind of income. And then once the eldest had done it, there was sort of a path laid for the next three. But, I mean, you know, talk about instilling work ethic and good values and giving kids skin in the game. You know, the parents probably could have paid for this on their own. You know, these are two relatively successful professionals. But they chose not to. And I think it's paid incredible dividends in terms of the amount of responsibility that those kids, now young adults, have taken on for themselves.
Well, on that note, we have to say goodbye to you. Ron Lieber, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's working on a book to be called The Opposite of Spoiled. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.